dog.
Exciting.
Sounds big.
Do you like dogs?
Yeah.
Good.
Hi.
Who's this?
Oh, he's
okay. Hi, lovely.
Hi, lovely to meet you. I'm Renee.
Hello, Renee. Hi.
Someone told me once, right, that they were talking to somebody and there were three black people walking down the street. There were two men and there was one woman. And they were both white, these people. And I said, describe what you can see. And the person said, well, I can see three black people. If they had been three white people, the person would have said, I can see two guys and a woman. I am absolutely and always have been perfectly aware that if I'm going to be in a room, my voice is going to be the one that is least sought out. So you just have to be louder than every other fucker.
Pauline Black is the original Rude Girl. As the driving force behind Coventry two-tone group The Selector, she was a rare woman of colour making her way in music during a notably sexist and racist decade. She is a style icon and a cultural force with her signature fedora, Doc Martens and formidable attitude, and she's still making music as The Selector today. Pauline invited us into her immaculate home in the Midlands to discuss how she became the First Lady of Ska and why politics is life.
Can you just walk me through what the Rude Girl persona was about and how you created that?
I have absolutely no idea what the Rude Girl persona is, other than I got on stage and I started singing some songs, ska songs, with an offbeat rhythm, and it kind of developed from there. I mean, it was never meant to have any particular sexual connotations in terms of the fact that, you know, I was making myself attractive for men or whatever. It was just that this seemed a way to go, and I felt that I needed to be taken relatively seriously, i.e. in what I had to say and all those kind of things. And I wanted a no-nonsense image that, you know, no peering up skirts and stuff like that, that would be not scary on stage, but would certainly say, right, this is my place and I feel comfortable here and this is what I want to wear and you're just going to have to put up with that. The hat was probably the last thing that came along, and that kind of finished it off, really.
Talk me through, what was your favourite or most memorable stage outfit, or maybe even what you're wearing now?
No, my favourite was a white Fred Perry with tips on the collar, and I got this absolutely gorgeous kind of boxy jacket with zips on the pockets and sort of black cigarette pants, really. Always your loafers had to look as though they'd had a row with your trousers. So there was a kind of, you know, modicum of sock, always preferably white. And my hats I used to get from an old man shop here in Coventry opposite Sainsbury's on Corporation Street called Dunn and Company. And they used to go all into a bit of a faff every time I used to walk in there because they didn't really know what this young black woman was doing coming in and choosing their grey fedoras. Well, I'd been an embryonic musician for about a couple of years, I suppose, before I joined The Selector. And I had been writing songs, doing other people's songs, mainly kind of Dylan, Joni Mitchell. So I started frequenting folk clubs, because that was the place where you could just sort of rock up with a guitar, sit down. They sort of looked to me as some sort of exotic thing that had just come in, like, oh, we don't usually get any black people in here kind of thing. But anyway, you know, bang one out, Pauline, we'll have a listen. And so that was it, really. Well, I'd been trying to get together a reggae band, and in that band were two people who would go on to be in The Selector and had played with various other, all the musicians who were around the Coventry scene who were into ska at that time. But Linville Golding from The Specials came down because he was friends with the keyboard player. He'd come down to us, I don't know, meandering our way through a few kind of reggae sort of songs that we penned ourselves, and at the end of the session turn around to myself and Charles H. Bembridge, who would then become the drummer in The Selector, and Desmond Brown, and said, I think you should meet these guys that I know. And I was given an address. I went round to that address, and everyone who was in that room would end up in The Selector. I don't think we really thought about sort of creating a new culture at the time. We definitely wanted to create a new way of maybe thinking about music, using music to demonstrate unity, i.e. Mixing up black, white, you know, black people, white people in a band. It wasn't that it hadn't been done before, but we consciously did it. It was like you were demonstrating to anyone who came to see you unity by the fact that you're all coexisting on a stage. You're all getting along, you know. And for seven people to get along in a band and make music, that's quite significant. I think The Selector embodied the Black British experience because we were part of a whole which included Black British music in terms of Black British reggae. That was beginning to come to the fore. You'd got bands like Steel Pulse, Misty and Roots, and you know, Dennis Bavell was working in London. He was working with the Slits. He was embracing what was good about punk. You had also got people like John Lydon, Johnny Rotten at the time, of the Sex Pistols, was taking over like John Peel's show and playing reggae, you know, imports, things like this that he was getting that nobody had ever heard before. So it was a fascination with each other's cultures. And of course, you got Bob Marley coming over here. And that was the first time that, you know, people had seen like a proper dread, as it were. And the I3s and, you know, Judy Mowat and people like that. It was like, this was all incredible. The politics was in there. It was implicit in the music. When Marley did things like Trenchtown Rock or Exodus, that was where he was coming from. And there were plenty of kids over here who could identify with that kind of thing, because you were feeling like a stranger in a strange land here. It was like you'd been to school with your white schoolmates and things like that. But, you know, you could still be called the N-word sort of on your way home or any of those kind of things. You knew you were not on a level playing field. And what Two Tone arguably was trying to do was put music on a level playing field, like you were welcome in this place, black or white, let's make music together. Protest music, it was always the first music that interested me. I think as a black person, well, the first music that really interested me was Tamla Motown, because you'd never seen any black artists before so fully in charge of what they were doing, you know, with a black producer, Berry Gordy, all of these kind of things. It was something that came out of America and just hit you. People like Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder used to do relatively political songs, you know, like Village Ghetto Land is just great. I mean, Superstition, it was all at the time when the civil rights movement was going on in America. Nightly, pretty much on the TV, the kind of stuff that you would see would be pictures of black people getting beaten up because they wanted to sit at lunch counters, and this active kind of strange apartheid thing that was going on in the Deep South at that time, and young black people being denied access to universities, or to any teaching really, if white kids were in the school as well. And the Kennedys, they had implemented a thing of busing of children so that schools are more integrated. They try to integrate schools in the South. And this just kind of brought every redneck racist that lived in the South out onto the streets. And you used to see these pictures of white people, I mean, who, you know, who looked perfectly normal, sort of, you know, in their little white hats, the ladies and their white gloves and all this kind of nonsense, and the guys in shirt and just come from work, would be frothing at the mouth when they saw this kind of thing. Like, that wasn't going to happen. And I think that was the first time I really began thinking there is something profoundly different here, and I better find out about this. Why these things happen. In the 70s, I don't know, 76, 77, something like that, Eric Clapton had a bit of a racist rant on Birmingham Odeon stage and said that he agreed with Enoch Powell and all of these things, which was Enoch Powell's assertion at that time was that you keep letting people in of another culture and another color, and the black man will, that those were his words, the black man will have the whip hand over you. Really, that's kind of an ethos which has pervaded through since he uttered those words. There are people in this country who actually believe that, which is just, you know, demographically is nonsense. It was after his racist rant that people got involved, and, you know, Rock Against Racism was formed and those kind of things. And there was an understanding within this country that as young people, that it didn't have to be like that. You didn't have to be like your parents. Two Tone happened in the middle of New Romantics and punk. It was, we were just tribal, for want of any other word. And you belonged to that tribe, and that tribe fetched up. And over there might be mods, and over here there might be skinheads, and they all had their different ways of dressing. And you just stood around like peacocks at a bar, do you know what I mean? And like, they're here. Okay, they look cool. It kind of started around 78, and it started with the Specials, Jerry Dammers in particular. And he came up with that whole idea for the Two-Tone Man, which we call Walt Jabsco. But he also put together a band that mixed up really kind of punk and rock, reggae initially, and then found that ska music, because it's more upbeat and it's a little faster, made it very, very danceable. It was an original thought, but the Clash were there and they had mixed punk and reggae, but they'd just done it in a different way, and they gave a support slot to the Specials, and the Specials gave a support slot to the Selector, which was the band I was in, and that kind of grew. But we had different ways of mixing the sound with ska. We mixed it more with reggae and ska, maybe, and the Specials mixed it more with rock. I was adopted by white parents, and they were white working class parents. My dad worked near Ford's and worked 7 days a week, kind of 12 hours a day and all those kind of things. My mum just stayed at home. I went on a journey to find my mother because she was the only one who was going to tell me who my dad was. So that was 1996. So it was some years ago now. Why did I do it? If I'd been white, I might not have chosen to. But I wasn't. And I felt that I needed to find out where I had come from. I had some definitive answers to the questions that I was asking. So that's why I went looking. I kind of knew she was about 17, 18 years older than I was. She was, in fact, 17 years older than me. And, you know, that put her into her late 50s. And I thought, maybe I'd better do something about this now, because if I leave it another 10 years, she might die. Then I'll never find out. And fortunately, she was still alive and thriving in Australia. And I asked her, I said, who was my dad? And she said, oh, he was good in a Oladosu Denle. She told me that he was Nigerian and how she'd met him and stuff like that. And I knew that, yeah, Adenles were probably going to be a fairly kind of, you know, a clan that was not going to be difficult to find. I would find an Adenle somewhere and they might be able to lead me to whatever. And the phone book in London, because I started there, had two Adenles. One was one of his wives, and the other was my half-sister. I ended up being the oldest of 18 of his children, I think. He'd had 18 children, and he'd had eight wives. Some kind of, you know, he'd married, some he hadn't. And yeah, so I inherited a whole load of other siblings, as it were, some who lived here, and cousins, and, you know, this huge extended family. Unfortunately, he had died the year before I found the key to all this, as it were. So that was a bit of a downer. But I always said that I was looking for the man who coloured me black. I'd named myself Black by deed poll, only just to sort of really get up the nose of my white adoptive family, because they always called me coloured and I was really pissed off with that. And so then they had to call me Black. I was lucky enough to be at a time when there were other strong females in bands, people like Debbie Harry within Blondie, people like Chrissy Hynde in The Pretenders, people like Polystyrene in X-Ray Specs. The Slits were around at that time. Susie Sue was around at that time. Kate Bush was around at that time. They covered a whole spectrum. I mean, the wonderful thing about being a woman is that there's a wonderful spectrum of artistic sensibility that women put into their music that you don't find anywhere else. You don't find it in men's music in that way. There's all kinds of... I don't know of another counterpart, say, to people like Kate Bush. But I don't really know of too many counterparts to what I did or what Polystyrene did. It's just different. You'd be hard pushed to go back in time and find anything that actually deviated too far from a thread of racism and sexism, really. And in terms of whatever you're trying to put out there, you know, it falls into those categories, really. I've never really bothered myself too much about anything else. I mean, as a black female, I sometimes look at the feminist movement and think, this is about white women. This isn't about me. White women expect me to come and fight their struggles with them. And I will always do that, because I think that feminism is great, you know, sort of that's the way forward, I mean, for women. But often black women will have struggles, but they don't get that same quantity of white ladies donning their pink pussy hats and all the rest of it coming along to fight their struggles for them. So as a black woman, you have to pick your struggles. And for me at the time, and still now, was racism was the thing that I felt held me back far more than the fact that I was a woman. I mean, as a black woman, I was bottom of the pile anyway, in terms of the pecking order of things. If you take the white male at the top, then the black male, and then, you know, the white female, and then the black female, because that's what the pecking order is. I knew that in pretty much in 1968, and I don't really see that those things have changed that much for all of the hashtags that we have come up with in that time. Still, those kind of things prevail. I will say this, since the Brexit vote happened, I feel that many racists within this country now feel emboldened to come out and loudly say to anyone who will listen, you see, I told you so, multiculturalism doesn't work, blah, blah, blah. And when you look to the fool that is in charge over in America at the moment, you can see how that is all feeding into a general pervasiveness of the Western world about how things are. Look, life is politics, or politics is life. Without opinions, what's the point in doing any art at all? I don't know any other way to be on a stage other than that way. I find politics probably the most entertaining thing in the world, because it's the thing that actually has a direct effect on my life. And it's a thing that I can direct to a certain extent. So even my dog is political. That was a woof of approval. Whether you need the selector now more than ever, I really don't know the answer to that. I think the question is that why are we still here? Why are we still here 40 years later? We came up with plenty of other bands who've completely gone by the wayside. But the nucleus of the two-tone movement is still around and still commanding audiences of certain sizes, because racism and sexism hasn't gone away. I mean, it's, we serve a purpose. And I think that as time goes on, that more and more people will see that, that purpose is probably a good thing. And I'm sure that there'll be younger bands as well who start being as vocal as maybe what we were in the past too.
This episode was produced by me, Renee Richardson. For more In the Last Bohemian series, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, follow on Spotify and Google Podcasts. You can see the portrait series at www.thelastbohemians.co.uk.